I could stay on Opus 4.6 and run a whole damn sock for the foreseeable future. It's maybe the most magic tool we've ever held, if wielded properly and responsibly, right? And that's a big if, because I see more folks not doing it that way than that are doing it that way. It does not replace all the other things. It's maybe one of the best bridges to some of those gaps that we've had in a long time.
I feel like it's kind of repetitive at this point to kind of give the little bit of an intro here. Hopefully it's not the first time that anybody's attending kind of Defender Fridays. If you are, usually we're just having interesting conversations with people in security. And this is our last show. So if it's your last one, your first one, I'm sorry.
There's an archive.
Right, that's right. There's a big archive. That's right. And for those that don't know, Eric is really the one who started it a couple years ago. I think we were just talking about that this morning. It's a few years back. So we thought it was like fitting to have Eric as the last guest. Plus, it's always super interesting discussions. So I was like, yep, that's perfect. Feel free to jump in, like if you want to chat, have discussions about all that stuff. How you doing, Eric? How's life?
I'm good, man. Thank you for asking. Yeah, no, I'm great. I've been meaningfully engaged in a lot of really exciting stuff. And as you know, I have been directly coupled with Lima Charlie in so many ways over the last several years. I remain probably one of your biggest fans. And I still to this day, I am beyond grateful for the fact that you guys make it possible for students and people that are looking to learn how an EDR works and how a detection engine works, that you guys make these things available as a free tier, like AWS is saying, hey, come and learn the components. And I remain incredibly grateful for that, because the so you want to be a SOC analyst training that I sell for pay what you can, right? So I sell it, but not really. I don't make any money on it. It's really just to cover the cloud hosting for the VMs. But I've pushed through somewhere in the ballpark of 500 to 600 students through that class. And it's only possible because you guys make that platform available for free for students, and that just I just can't tell you enough how great that is. And that's just one of the dozens of reasons why I love you guys. But no, I'm great, man. I've been very, very busy, very engaged. I'm still doing a lot of training work, a lot of operations work, and a whole ton of consulting. And I've spent probably the better part of the past year in building out agentic workflows for SOC teams. And so it's like all I think about day and night. It's kind of a problem. Maxime knows this actually, because I spun up a signal group for just close friends that I know are equally as addicted as I am. Yeah, and we called it Coding Agents Anonymous, because I'm like, man, we need a support group. We need like a place to come in and just vent and talk smack about the latest models. And yeah. But yeah, I'm great, man. So, but I really appreciate you guys letting me come on. It's kind of special. It's bittersweet, but it was really dear to me that you guys invited me to be on the last show.
Awesome. So happy to hear about, I mean, the whole thing. It is pretty cool too. I think like you're mentioning your course, and every now and then, like we've got an internal channel, right? When we like see people creating accounts and all that, and it's easy to forget, but there is kind of a constant stream, essentially, like almost every day, of just various training, not companies, but like organizations of all kinds kind of coming through. So that is really cool. And so you kind of touched on, I think, what I think certainly for me is kind of like the biggest interest. I'll be selfish here, but I think you're one of the few people out there that is doing a lot of work on the agentic stuff, kind of in operations and with direct contact with the enemy, right? Meaning, it's not like hey, you know, we're like building this thing and maybe we have a design partner, but it's like really like building the real thing. So that's why I always enjoy anytime we get to have like this conversation. I'm kind of curious maybe to like get started is like, how's things changed recently? I mean, I think there's maybe the elephant in the room is like also Fable this week, but even before then, right? Like how's this year been so far? Has there been like a big shift or a big like learning for you that you're like, ah, shit, that really changes how we go and do things?
Hands down, man. I think there was some kind of inflection point for me, at least around February, March. That was what, Opus 4.6. I don't know why February, March. There's something about February, March that like I feel like we hit a level with Anthropic's models that really just blew the doors off what was possible. Because, you know, before that, it was like, hey, we can do some cool things. You know, we can do a little bit of coding. We can write a little bit of detection logic and all that stuff. And then, like I said, I feel like it was around 4.6 that like the models just became so good. But it was also coupled with a lot of hard lessons learned. So I would say probably one of the most impactful things that I've learned in my journey of trying to build, you know, reliable and consistent, you know, agentic and automated workflows. Cause like, that's where my bread and butter is. Like I'm long past the days of copying, pasting things between, you know, a chat session. While that was like the initial introduction for everyone into AI, you know, ChatGPT is like, okay, yes, this is helping me. But like, this is also very slow and very tedious. Like, you know, there's gotta be a better, faster way. And that's where like the coding agents really kind of took off. But pushing things into like automated runners and scheduling things to happen all day and all night, that's where everything changed. Because I'll tell you, like, so for instance, take some of the less sexy stuff on the SOC, but still critical, like detection engineering, tuning false positives, right? Like nobody enjoys doing these things, but they must get done. But the problem is it's time consuming. It's very time consuming, very detail oriented work. And who's going to do that when everyone's busy fighting fires, right? Because there's no SOC anywhere that I've ever seen where they're sitting around saying, huh, I wonder when the next ticket's coming in. No, like they're constantly battling to try to get their head above water, and the water doesn't stop coming. And so the problems that I saw before agentic workflows started kind of taking hold is that those critical but non-urgent things like detection engineering, false positive tuning fell to the wayside. They just weren't happening. And it was one of those like, shh, we don't talk about that. Like the backlog of false positives, we don't talk about that. You know, the fact that we're developing 10, 20, 30 new detections a year, we don't talk about that either. It's like, that's not how this is supposed to work, and that's not how it can sustain. So how do we solve the problem? Well, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago, it was, well, hire more bodies, hire more bodies, hire more bodies. But the problem with that is it's not an instant fix. It's expensive to hire a lot more people, and it still is not a guaranteed solution to the problem, because you might be bringing in junior people that can't really do those things well. And so anyway, so I don't really need to describe the problem to the types of folks on this call. Most people are well aware of the problem, but the solutions that I've leaned into is it's very similar to the same journey and promise around SOAR. When SOAR came about, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago, SOAR was this like superpower, but out of the box, it was nothing. Right? Like you had to bring the smarts to it. And now you needed someone that could write Python. You need someone that could build integrations. But if you did have those inputs, if you had the builders that could build those things, the SOAR could be the single most impactful thing you've ever introduced into your security stack, right? Because now you're automating a lot of the toil, a lot of the manual stuff, so that you're freeing up analyst time to do a lot of stuff. Okay, so SOAR, when wielded correctly, was a massive improvement to operations. Well, agentic workflows are like the next version of that. But the problem is It requires that same deep expertise. You've basically got to take the sum of all the smartest people in your on your team that understand, the tool stack, they understand the business, they understand the dependencies of all of it. And then you've got to capture the workflows that they've been doing manually by hand for years. You got to capture those workflows and you've got to vet them and test them and run them through pipelines of training essentially agents to replicate that work. And I would say one of the most important lessons that I've learned in the process is, yes, you've got to have all that rock solid expertise baked in, but then it's adding deterministic checkpoints at every step, right? And so one of the mistakes that I see teams make is they just throw GPT or Codex or Copilot or Claude at it, and they're like, hey, do magic. And then they get disappointed when it doesn't nail it, right? Like, ah, this isn't that good. It's like, okay, but like that's on you to think that this generally trained model is going to be an expert at your specific way of writing the text or tuning false positives. That's not how this works. But it turns out with obviously a combination of, the right types of system prompts and reference files and constraints and all the ways that you can build up knowledge bases that agents can leverage, but then also couple that in with deterministic components at every layer where deterministic work can be done. And so it's like, hey, do I really need an LLM to figure out if this rule is valid and the syntax is correct? No, actually, that would actually be a horrible thing to use an LLM for. So let's add a deterministic checkpoint. Now, what you have is an agent that will occasionally make a little mistake here or there. But if you've got 15 different deterministic checkpoints throughout the process, guess what? The agent is self-correcting as it goes. So it writes a rule and then it tests the rule and then it sees a problem and it fixes the problem and then it validates again and then over and over and over. And what you get when you've fleshed out this process is you get a perfect product every single time. And I know this is true because I'm doing it every day. I'm helping teams do it every single day. But there's labor that goes into it. But the ROI on that labor is insane. I've got one team I'm working with right now that they increased their detection engineering output by 900 in the last 8 to 10 months. 900x what their previous detection, like net new detection outputs were. 900 increase by just implementing agentic workflows that are running day and night, day and night. So their analysts wake up in the morning, they go look in their queue where detection work is happening, and they're just saying, yeah, that looks good, approve. Oh, yeah, that looks good, approve. So there's always that human in the loop, but the work is done. You're just coming in to say, is it done? Yes, there's the 15 deterministic checks, they all pass. There's the summary of what this rule is for. And so anyway, that's been, Max, in my opinion, one of the most game-changing aspects is not that, I mean, and yes, we're using it for investigative workflows and all that fun stuff too, but that's even harder to get right. But it's outsourcing the toil that still requires deep intelligence, but it's still toil. Detection work, false positive tuning is toil that your analysts will never make time for. So work on that first and then move to the big complex investigative, workflows because that's where a lot more supervision, a lot more variables, a lot more, instructions and constraints and things like that need to be considered and written, or else now you're outsourcing one of the most important aspects of the job to an intern that may or may not get it right. And that's not really the risk you want to take. David, did you got a hand up? Go ahead, sir.
Yeah,
And
hey
good to
man.
see you, by the way, David.
Yeah, ditto. It's been a while. A question for you. How do you determine, or how are you determining what model to use? So, for example, whenever I'm using like Claude or Code or something, I typically use the latest model unless I'm doing anything cybersecurity related, in which I'm stuck on like 4.6, or else it says, hey, you're doing something you shouldn't be. So I'm curious, what do you do? Like, how do you determine what's good enough? And do you have any kind of like, I guess, data-driven kind of thing to do any sort of measurements around that, or I'm curious how you approach that.
So there's a couple different ways I like to think about it. So first of all, cost over everything, right? Is especially if you're going to be building autonomous workflows, they're going to be running all day and all night all the time. Like your number one concern now is what's this going to cost me? right? Because as you guys know, these bills climb fast, especially if you're on, API. And by the way, what is it? June 12th, in what is it, 2 or 3 days? Anthropic's throwing the ban hammer on using subscription accounts, even team and enterprise subscription accounts for any kind of automated work, including CI runners and all that. So a whole lot of usage that used to be covered under like a flat rate subscription is all about to go to API billing. So cost is like number one. So it's thinking about what is the cheapest model that can efficiently do this task. But there's a bell curve though, where, okay, let's say I'm gonna start with I'm drawing a blank. What's the one between Haiku, Sonnet? I'm gonna start with Sonnet. That's usually like my default just starting point when I'm building something that is gonna be high volume, is let's start with Sonnet. But then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna benchmark it. How effective, how efficient is Sonnet on this task? Because if it's making too many mistakes that the deterministic checks end up having to catch and tell it to fix, well, if I can't fix that in the instructions, if it truly feels like a model limitation, then now I know my answer. Like, it's actually going to be more expensive to run this on Sonnet because it's going to have to freaking crank on it so much more than if I were to throw Opus at it and it nails it on the first try, right? And so it's finding the balance between what is the lowest level model that can efficiently knock this out, but it also depends on what are the stakes of the task that I'm doing, right? Because, like, for instance, take FP tuning, for instance, right? Which is sadly one of the things that gets pushed to the furthest back burner. But like, FP tuning is a critical stakes operation because one mistake in putting in some kind of global FP could cause a massive blind spot across the entire enterprise. And the number of times I've seen that happen, man, is greater than one, which means way too freaking high. So when it comes down to that, now I'm not nickeling and diming now because I want to have a brilliant model doing the gap assessment on that. Maybe Sonnet could write the FP. I'm going to have Opus review that thing adversarially almost, right? Like, I want you to find the problem with this. I want you to, and so, but the good news is the heavier lift was writing the rule and doing the research and analyzing the gigabytes of raw data to figure it out. And then the Opus job is actually technically lighter, but it's smarter, right? So it's going to be doing like the QA against it. And so it really kind of depends, David, but it's cost is usually the first driving factor. And then the level of the stakes of the task at hand. But then keep in mind that it's not like it has to be one size fits all for the job. I have agentic workflows that are using multiple different models throughout the flow. It's like, hey, Haiku this, Haiku that, Haiku this, Sonnet this, and then Opus that, right? And so you can kind of distribute that a bit, even all within the same workflow, using the harness or whatever that you're using to call those jobs.
One other quick follow-up question. Another thing that I've been kind of experimenting around with and I'd love to feedback on is using sub-agents. I've maybe gotten carried away to almost where I'm using a dedicated sub-agent per like individual process. And even to the point where like the Claude Code GUI was too slow and I realized you could use a Python script to call the Claude Code CLI and pipe it in via like command lines and doing like a multi-threaded recursion, just maxing out the CLI. But I guess the TLDR is, have you done any, I guess, testing or anything around like determining where you think it's best to maybe keep a singular agent per task or where it's maybe grouped to batching them up and how you kind of determine again that is it do you do anything about like your average token counts that you expect it to ingest or I'm curious what you how you take that into account.
Sure. So here's this is strictly vibes, David. Let me be clear. I'm not like reading from any sort of like academic level white paper here. But I have learned that there is a point of diminishing returns for sure when you're parallelizing and calling out the sub-agents because now but there's definitely a right time and place to do it though. But I've gone too far where I built an agent team of like 8, 10 sub agents because I in my mind I thought they all need to be hyper specialized in a certain task. And what I learned was there was massive token waste. And then you start having communication issues between agents, especially if they're running tasks in parallel. And so what I learned is fewer is usually better, right? Like the simplest answer is usually the right one. And so what I thought about was, okay, I've got these 8 agents that I think all need to specialize. But actually, if I really dilute it down, what I have are six agents that are doing similar work just in different directions. Well, okay, then let's just have a single agent that hyper specializes in that type of work. But then maybe I've got skills that it calls when it's going to point this way or point that way or point this way, right? And by reducing the number of sub agents, you're reducing, reducing token cost, but also you're reducing the degradation of communication between them. Because your main session, which is typically like your orchestrator, when it shells out to a sub agent, it does not necessarily see everything that went down in that session. It gets a summary back, which means there's a little bit of dilution, right? So if I've got that happening over and over and over and over and over again, that dilution just kind of multiplies at that point. And so the fewer, the better, in my opinion. But every use case is a little bit different. But I was going to say also, David, be careful about that. What you're doing now, that basically you're shelling out Claude, right, with dash P or something in the background just to run non-interactive. Like, be careful because that's the kind of usage that's about to come under new billing in a day or two.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore. I made a $30,000 bill, so.
And yeah, I saw somebody's I think Eric's comment around like the billing of tools. That's also what we're really seeing. I mean, the most success is it's not about using the model to kind of like shoving everything in the context of the model and getting it to crunch. It's about using the when people say the agentic aspect, like that's what it's like. To use the model to build the tooling that it needs to go and accomplish the goal. And what we found is like very often there's a lot of good old boring Python script stuff, like build a playbook here, like hook this up to this, and then it takes all the heavy lifting away from the model. So it's left to just really be like zeroed in and effective.
I don't know if you're speaking to Joshua's question. Joshua, I don't know if you joined late, but I kind of spoke directly to your concern earlier that the goal is actually to lean as little on the language model for the validation and verification as possible. Because you're
100%.
right, like how do I trust the left hand, to keep tabs on the right hand? They're both hands. I don't know,
100%.
so the goal is when building agentic workflows, you should be pushing absolutely everything possible into deterministic steps, but specifically the checkpoints, the validations, the quality assessments. So like for instance, the last detection engineering workflow that I built has something like 16 individual validators that run at every single step of the process. I mean, there are so many checks and balances, it's actually kind of ridiculous at this point, which means like the LLM is doing the non-deterministic stuff that it does, but it cannot proceed until all 16 of these checks pass. Well, what happens when a new edge case, a new error state is discovered? Well, now we end up with a 17th validator, right? So I don't believe in using or relying too heavily on LLM instructions to be your quality checks and your gates, because you're literally leaning on the thing that has a tendency to mess things up or forget things or context, the instructions slide out of context. So it's deterministic checkpoints like through and through and through and through. And I'll tell you, one of the things I like to do just periodically, like a housekeeping check, is I drop into a workflow that's been running for a while and we have a long conversation about, let's still root out what steps of this could and should be deterministic. Python scripts, what have you, right? Because it not only is that going to help reduce the cost, but it's adding more consistent, more reliable, steps to the process, Josh. So I appreciate your perspective there because you're 100% right. I cannot trust LLMs to monitor LLMs to monitor LLMs. That's a recipe for disaster and an astronomical bill from the provider.
We maybe put it a different way, but similar philosophy in that we try everything we can to not use an LLM. And then the LLM adds something I can't get any other way. It is valuable, but it's only for an exceedingly small amount of stuff that we cannot figure out any other way. It's kind of you have you don't, cake isn't very good without icing. But the bulk of the thing is cake. Right, there's a little bit icing, but without that icing, it's not a delicious thing, so that's kind of our philosophy.
And Joshua, I'll tell you just to add some more sort of credence to what you're saying. One of the biggest failure modes that I'm seeing right now are orgs that are prematurely going all in on AI, and they never finished the hygiene of 2010, 2015, and here we are, 2026, and they're like all in agentic AI, all this stuff, and that's a disaster every single time. Because Joshua, to your point, and I know you guys are a heavy machine learning firm, right? And so you already know the data quality requirements and all that good stuff. Well, so when you got organizations that never stop to go back and clean up those messes, their data quality is a mess, their schemas, their all that stuff is just kind of just neglected and under the hood. Throwing an LLM at those things not only is going to be cost prohibitive, but the quality will never be consistent and reliable and trustworthy, because like the inputs are not, right? And so if the inputs are trash, the outputs are going to be trash. And so you're 100% right. Like, that's why I like to think about it this way, because here's the problem, Joshua. Like, if I come in as a consultant, I can't fix the last 15 years of their data quality problems. I can tell them that they need to do it, but like that's a 12-month project. But they're paying me to come in and say, agentify us. Okay. Well, the only mitigating strategy that I have is deterministic validations at every single point of the flow, because I know the LLM is not going to be able to handle the variables and the unknowns reliably every time.
I'll go a little far. I agree with that. I'll go a little bit farther and maybe try to blow you guys' minds. The sophistication of the what I would call time series models that we use in UEBA, for example, it's kind of sucks. And I think everybody on here would sort of agree that UEBA isn't really that great. It's a lot of false positives, and anomaly detection has a lot of false positive stuff. I don't think we're done ex getting, I don't think we have anywhere near the quality we can get out of the concept of anomaly detection. I think we've not even, we haven't done very well at modeling, traditional modeling on time series data, and that we shouldn't stop. Developing, we shouldn't give up on UEBA style or time series modeling style stuff, because you guys haven't seen yet what we can do with those kind of models if we get them right. So it's more than just the data quality of an enterprise, which I agree is horrible in many cases, and it's not time to go to AI, but also that there's so much more we can do with traditional modeling. And I hate to see the whole industry sort of walk away from 200 years of statistical research, because now we have this shiny toy of AI. So.
I have to. I'm gonna use a slightly tongue-in-cheek contrarian view here, just to make it interesting. I think it's. I'll start by saying, like, I generally agree with you guys, which kind of undoes my whole point. But I think what's interesting is that, I'll use Eric. You were talking about, like, those 16 points of, like, deterministic checks. As the models get bigger, like, it's a grayscale, right? Because if LLMs truly could not be trusted for anything at all, then we wouldn't be using them for anything at all, because, like, nothing would work. So it sort of means, like, okay, it works to a certain extent, and it's not a binary, like, reliable, not reliable. It's kind of like somewhere on that spectrum. And I think what we've seen over the past few years is, like, that point keeps moving to get better and better and better. Now, the economics, I think, haven't fully played out, but conceptually, there's a point where we're going to be able to say, hey, you know what? You're totally right. A deterministic, check is, like, 100%, but my LLM or ALLM, the model is now, going to be 99.9999%. And so the 50 hours it takes me to go and make sure all those deterministic checks are okay are just not worth it anymore. Like, it's an ROI question. And I feel like,
Right.
there's some really hard problems that are probably going to be the last ones. I'm starting to feel like we're kind of at the point where, I think Eric, you mentioned it earlier. The simple, like the simple, really well scoped, like certainly that's what we hit a lot of, like there's a queue, all of the elements in that queue just need to be evaluated in a specific way and then like come up with a conclusion. I feel like we're kind of at the point where we can mostly one shot those with the opus models, right? So that
Without a
economics
doubt,
different.
man. Without a doubt. Like I swear right now, man, I could stay on Opus 4.6 and run a whole damn SOC for the foreseeable future. Right. Like, so the new model's coming out, great. But I agree with you, Max, that it's inevitable. Nothing has ever moved at the speed that this industry is moving. And it's not the magic solution, but I will tell you, it's maybe the most magic tool we've ever held. If wielded properly and responsibly, right? And that's a big if, because I see more folks not doing it that way than that are doing it that way. But the industry will mature. But again, it does not replace all the other things. It's not a substitute for hygiene and clean data and all that other stuff. But it's maybe one of the best bridges to some of those gaps that we've had in a long time. So yeah, it's exciting stuff.
I got a quick question going back to the AI kind of SOC workflows. I just popped into chat something that I was reading about today about how malware is actually starting to use prompt injections in the like files themselves to, I guess, do some sort of evasion should you use an LLM to try and analyze it. I'm curious on two fronts. One, going back to models adding protection. So like, for example, as an enterprise user, we are having to use like a Bedrock style model where you can't get that cyber use case exemption. So I'm curious at how frequently, one, you're running into false positives. Because whenever I use 4.8, for example, I could be using totally blue team, just, hey, pull threat reports. And it's like, hey, you're doing something you shouldn't be, something totally benign. So I'm curious at if how often you're seeing that disrupt AI SOC workflows is a part one. And then part two, how are you baking in and taking into account malware and attacks that may start including prompt injection style instructions? Or have you even really kind of thought about
It's,
that?
in my opinion, it's not rushing to the point that you're dumping untrusted and almost certainly bad things into the context window of an LLM, right? That's not use case one, two, or three, in my opinion. The first use cases that I focused on and built out were ones where it's trusted inputs, always, only trusted inputs. Right. And so, because great care, great caution has to be taken when you're saying, hey, here's some malware. Let's take a look at this together. That's giving teenagers a potato gun, right? And saying, please don't get arrested. It's going to happen. And so that's step one. And step two is obviously that's a case, David, where you always lean on the smartest possible model that you have available to you, because the smarter models are more resistant to it. And so on and so forth. But then it also comes back to, am I using this big expensive guessing machine to do something that we've already got really decent deterministic technology to handle? Sandboxing, right? If I can just sandbox this and get a concrete answer, that might be, the fastest, easiest, and cheapest thing. Because what am I really trying to figure out here, right? What am I, do I need an LLM to figure out, does this thing install a persistence item on this box? I do not need an LLM to figure that out. So it's coming back to one, am I using the right tool for the job? And two, if it does need to be LLM, then okay, that's when it's time to start baking in all the defenses and mechanisms. And even then, there's no way to eliminate the risk. It's just what reduction can I put in place? And by the way, not to shamelessly plug the LC guys here, but if you don't know about it, I'm sure you do, but if you don't know about it, you got to go check out VibRails, man. Because that's what we're doing. That's how I roll. Is I've got VibRails set up on all my coding agents. That way, I've got introspection, and not only introspection into what's going on, but I've got interception capabilities as well. So when that thing happens that shouldn't have happened, there's a detection rule that'll shut it down. So yeah, that's probably a topic, David, that we can't cram into this already overtime call.
Yes. I mean, we could easily keep chatting all day. I'm sure you have a lot of other stuff to do, so maybe we'll call it. I will say, I know you're going to be at Black Hat. We will as well. Anybody here, if you want to get together, have a beer, talk about interesting things, do let us know. I think that's kind of like the perfect setting, the perfect place to do that. Thanks, Eric, for coming. That was really a super interesting discussion. I'm sure there will be many more. Thanks everybody for coming to the last instance. It's sad, but I'm sure there's going to be other opportunities, other ways that that we can kind of
That's
get
good. That
folks
maybe
around
we can
this.
do these a little bit ad hoc whenever a new model blows the scene up or something. We'll drag Eric back here and we can all rant about it.
Every 2 weeks. Well, hey, real quick, let me give Nicole a voice real quick. She's dropped it in chat a couple times, but definitely if anyone's going to be at Black Hat and you want to hang out with the Lima Charlie folks as well as me and a couple of my folks, come hang out at our workshop. We're going to be discussing building and running security operations like agents. So like whether you know nothing about it or whether you know a little bit about it or whether you just want to get to play with it in a sandbox, we're bringing all the toys. So come hang out with us at Black Hat. That's going to be a lot of fun.
That's right. And yeah, thanks for mentioning Eric, because like I think, when we were talking about exactly, what we do, I think there's kind of one core principle which we had here, which was like we don't want to do like demos. Like we want to put like the real thing in people's hands and like build things with people. And so yeah, do come. That's it's gonna be a lot of fun.
All right, folks, have a great rest of your Friday. Thanks, Max and team, for having me on.
Thank you. All
See you,
right.
bud.
See
See
you,
you guys.
everybody. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Defender Fridays discussion. Support our show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend, subscribe, or give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening from. If you want to be a part of the conversation and join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you in the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.